saw some interesting moments today in the Senate. Another confirmation hearing as Trump's pick to run the EPA, the dreaded job-killing EPA, actually told lawmakers that he doesn't believe climate change is a major crisis. Not a big deal. Not a big deal at all. And if he is confirmed, and this is, I go, really? Not a single Democrat had better vote for this guy. He says if confirmed, he's going to continue to attack all of the Obama-era emissions limits. I guess pollute, baby, pollute is his bumper sticker. He says, you know, global warming, you know, maybe an important issue, but not something the federal government should deal with. It's something for states and for the private sector to bring us. Yeah, understand, the private sector brought us this. Just kind of throwing that out there. Now they're saying, look, the chance he's going to get confirmed because Republicans control the Senate. But again, this is what happens when you have this mess. And here we are 26 days into the shutdown, and it's only going to get worse from here. And here to tell us what's going on in Washington, D.C., I've got Talk Media News Deputy Bureau Chief Justin Duckham on the line. Justin, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, great to be here, as always.
So, not a big deal. You know, it's not something, the climate, not something we should be really all that concerned with.
I mean, it's just so weird because you have the administration holding on to Scott Pruitt forever back when he was at the EPA, almost as if it was hard to find somebody else who could come in
and be as crazy.
The slashing and burning of Obama regulations, when really at the end of the day, it doesn't take much talent to be a complete and total arsonist, and that's what we're seeing with Andrew Wheeler as well. So it really just begs the question over what exactly they saw in the initial guy they had, why they went through all the embarrassment of having somebody who was pretty clearly corrupt, who was, staying with lobbyists, who was trying to do political favors for his spouse and whatnot, when they had him as a backup the entire time. And it, just really spells out that they want to carry out this heavy deregulatory agenda. They want to pretty much tear down the system as it exists right now, but they're not necessarily doing a great job at hiding it or doing it in a very politically savvy manner.
I don't think they care. At this point, I don't think they care that they're willing to let the planet burn. They don't care that they're actually, outwardly trying to destroy government. This has been their goal for 40 years. It's things that they've talked about on the campaign trail. They don't believe government should do anything. They should privatize everything. I fully expect if our government ever is reopened, and I have serious questions about that, that they start saying, you know what, we need to privatize all of this stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, if you believe the anonymous opinion piece that was in the Daily Caller earlier this week, I'm not sure if you saw that.
And I don't.
That was apparently from an anonymous senior administration official that basically made the case that you don't need a lot of these federal employees to actually be in their job, saying that what this shutdown is showing is that a lot of these people were basically unnecessary, were basically only there to hinder the president's agenda as part of this deep state fantasy that we've seen coming out of those who are within Trump's orbit. And just giving this bizarre sort of pseudo look at the world, one that doesn't necessarily match any sort of reality for how the day-to-day operations of the government actually works, that pretty much just displays what they may ultimately be going for, which is really troubling.
Yeah, the anonymous author of that, and 15% of the federal workforce are true patriots. Everyone else, I think he said, were a bunch of slackers and lazy and just taking up space. And I always find it interesting that people, when they write and say things like that, that they lump themselves into the really positive argument, and everybody else sucks. And it's interesting to me because here's a guy who probably spends his entire day worried about what everybody else is doing, and I'll bet you he doesn't do a damn thing himself.
There you go.
Because I know people like that. Everybody else is terrible. I'm terrific. And you go, what did you do today? You're watching everybody else.
If you're in government to provide certain services and whatnot, and you have this view as a senior member of the Trump administration, there's not really much you can point to in terms of there being a lot of accomplishments. So yeah. I share your view. I'm not exactly sure where this holier-than-thou attitude is coming from.
Yeah, and as I was reading it, I'm going, this doesn't sound like something an individual wrote. This sounds like, you know, one of those think tank hit pieces where let's cram all of our ideological assaults on working people and on federal workers and on public sector workers, and let's just throw it all into one anonymous op-ed piece, and we'll let somebody eventually take credit for it, and maybe we'll give them a job at a think tank down the road. But, you know, we're going to take all of our bad ideology and jam it, every anecdote, every I heard, throw it all in there, and it was garbage.
Yeah, it was a pretty strange piece to say the least, and it's really bizarre that we're not seeing the same level of attention that we saw with the New York Times anonymous op-ed. Obviously, you know, there are some pretty significant differences, but at the end of the day, this is somebody who is purporting to be a senior member of the Trump administration, sharing some views that are just absolutely abhorrent, especially when we have the president trying to portray himself as somebody who is looking out for the 800,000 people who are being adversely affected by the shutdown, trying to at least put a human face on it and a human spin to try to look like he's not completely out of touch.
Yeah.
And then we have this as a pretty stark and striking counterpoint, and something that the president himself shared on Twitter when he retweeted, his son who had shared the article online as well. So it really begs the question over whether or not this is something that the president himself actually believes.
He can relate, right? I mean, he can relate. He cares. And here's the thing that gets me. I mean, you know, while they're calling back all of these people to work without pay, and we've got, you know, 800,000, you know, some people, we got all these people working without pay. The question is, how long can they possibly go? I'm waiting for that moment where people are at the end of the rope and they're going, you know, there's got to be a general strike. There's got to be hey, we can no longer do this unless the White House is going to start, you know, open up a payday loan office. To where, hey, you know, we know someday you might get paid, and here, take out a loan with us. I mean, I'm waiting for something like that to pop up.
Well, you know, of course, we've had the message coming from the White House that, you know, this is sort of a vacation for a lot of these workers. They're going to be paid eventually, so they might as well enjoy the time off. But no, I mean, what we have with the IRS coming in is basically just an effort to forestall a political hailstorm that they would have had. That was initially the view that was shared by a lot of people over what exactly would bring the shutdown to an end. And the idea there was it would be when people didn't get their tax returns on time, when they realized that there was going to be a delay for that. So, you know, it really looks like this is an effort to put that aside, to basically tend to what is a political crisis rather than a major national security one or something where you could, I guess, conceivably justify drafting in people to work temporarily without pay. So just begs the question over where exactly the priorities are.
Yeah, doesn't seem to be any. And, you know, the interesting thing to me is, you know, I'm watching all these reports coming out of Washington and how where you're at, where, you know, the federal workforce, you know, makes up a good, you know, the mass of the labor force in that community. And, you know, restaurants, you know, their business levels are down like 75%. You know, the small business owners, if there are any left, they're all squealing because, look, there's nobody spending money. This is horrible for the economy. And it just seems to me, you know, I go back to, you know, Christmas Eve. You had Steve Munchkin there throwing out the, hey, banks are liquid thing. And I'm going, no, they weren't possibly liquid. And you've got all of these, you know, these things going on that it just seems like he's trying to cause the next recession.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty dire time, especially here in D.C. You know, there's some very visible signs of it being a crunch, not just at the airports, you know, where you see TSA agents going through some very difficult times. But all over Capitol Hill, there's basically a very anxious subsection of people who make up a disproportionate amount of the people that you run into every day who are just absolutely feeling the crunch and really questioning how long exactly they can keep this up for. You know, going a month without pay at this point, or 26 days approaching that, is particularly difficult, especially when you are in a job where it's not necessarily flush with cash.
No, I mean, I'll be honest. I'd be already looking for another job. It's one of those things where I personally don't know that I don't know it's going to reopen. I don't believe Trump cares. I don't buy that he relates. He feels their pain. I don't buy any of that. This is ideologically driven. There's a whole bunch of things at play here, but it's for the base of the Republican Party – They're just tingly in the panties over the fact that they can shut this down and then throw out the message of, see, your life isn't affected. We don't need all of that.
Yeah, and you know, that's the message that I'm sure they're going to be going with after, this notion that, look, we went without all of this and nobody really noticed it. You didn't notice it, yada, yada, yada. Trying to sweep under the rug the fact that this is hurting a lot of Americans, not just those who are directly employed, but, you know, spouses, families, and just a lot of day-to-day operations that are being basically hamstrung by this.
Yeah, crazy. Let's move on. Nancy Pelosi wants to postpone the State of the Union address, claiming, well, we're unsafe. What's going on?
Yeah, so this was something that came out early this morning where she basically put a very diplomatically worded letter saying that the president should consider rescheduling the State of the Union and perhaps submitting his State of the Union address to Congress in writing. Of course, knowing that this is the Speaker of the House, the person who is ultimately responsible for inviting the president to speak in the House of Representatives, this wasn't really just a mere request. This was somebody who absolutely has the power to call it off, basically putting the brakes on it and putting the White House in an uncomfortable position where, you know, we still haven't really gotten a clear-cut answer over what exactly they are going to do to get around this. This is something that, you know, obviously the president was itching for the chance to make his case again in a national to a national audience, you know, over why the shutdown is Democrats' fault, why there needs to be a wall in order to ensure border security, and why failing to do so will absolutely jeopardize every man, woman, and child in this country from scary people crossing the border and whatnot. And now the oxygen is pretty much sucked out of that, and there's no clear way over how exactly he can do it. So it's also being put forward with a pretty solid, sound justification. Pelosi saying that this is a national security special event, something that previously has been viewed as an all-hands-on-deck situation with the Secret Service. Generally, I believe there's TSA agents who are also brought in to help man security on that night, if I recall correctly, from previous State of the Union addresses I've attended. And, you know, with these agencies just hamstrung with DHS not being fully funded, it's a hard ask to pull off a national security event of this size and magnitude on short notice without people being paid. So Pelosi today said that this was a housekeeping measure, a national security measure, and although there were some efforts from DHS to say that's not the case, Democrats countered by saying that there were senior officials who reached out to them and told them that they were concerned as well. So it looks like we're not going to have that that big event come the end of the month.
Yeah, trust me, nothing bad is going to happen to the State of the Union speech. If anything, Russia will provide security because this guy's doing everything he can do to make Putin happy. So nothing will happen to anything on his covfefeed head. At least that's my view on it. But, you know, here's the thing that gets me. You know, if that's the case, if we can't provide security for, you know, for the State of the Union address, maybe we should postpone all the flights. Maybe we should postpone, you know, all of the, you know, train travel. Maybe we should postpone everything that we have to, that gets done, that, you know, anything the federal government has anything to do with, because we're all less safe. You know, last night on the program, I had Sarah Nelson on. She's the head of the American Flight Attendants Association. And because yesterday was the 10th anniversary of the Miracle on the Hudson, or as she put it, you know, people doing their job on a day really as they were supposed to. And as she pointed out, look, you know, that didn't just happen. It wasn't just one guy who was a hero. It was, you know, multiple agencies who had, you know, multiple years of training under federal programs that are now all shut down. Air traffic controllers took courses, you know, in emergency management and all this stuff that, you know, nobody ever thinks about, nobody ever, you know, cares about until some tragedy happens and people have to spring into action. And right now we're less safe, we're less secure because of this shutdown.
And what's really frightening is around the Hill, there are a lot of people who will privately concede that this probably isn't going to come to an end until there is a sense of tragedy or some kind of disaster that brings this all back together and pushes this forward. And that's a very troubling place to be in for a democratic society, to be basically hedging your bets on a political gambit until it's unfeasible in the sense that something terrible happened.
It's weird. And on Monday, I thought Lindsey Graham gave Trump the ultimate option. They gave him the out. They basically paved the path for him to just say, okay, fine, we're going to reopen the government. We're going to, if in 3 weeks we don't have some kind of a deal, I'm going to declare a national emergency and I'm going to do it anyway. Gave him the perfect out. I mean, if I'm looking at this going, that's a way to get the government back open and declare victory. So for me, it's not about the wall. It has nothing to do with that. It's about destroying our government. It's about tearing down the institutions that we've built. It's about creating instability, creating chaos, which is something Trump loves.
Yeah, I mean, he had two outs at this point. He had one, which was the national security or the national emergency route, which frankly would have made a lot of noise, but most likely would have been bogged down in court for a number of years. It would have given the president a chance to probably make some gains with his cable news supporters, the people who have been guiding a lot of his political and policy decisions for quite some time now. It would have given him a chance to lambast the courts for being out of date and just not doing doing the people's business and whatnot, something that he's done time and time again. And then he also had the Graham-backed proposal to temporarily reopen the government, let people go back to work, get things ready, and then continue wall negotiations. He would have still been able to carry out the slaps against Democrats, the grandstanding that he does on Twitter, while having the government reopened and having the temporary crisis and the actual real risks of that taken off the table. It would have been a politically safe move to do as well, especially when you had a prominent Republican, giving his stamp to it, something that we've already known Mitch McConnell would have supported since they've previously passed continuing resolutions in the Senate to do just that. But now he's turned down both of those, and there's just no clear path forward over breaking the impasse and getting us out of it.
Yeah, it's crazy. I understand that Trump met with a number of the no labels Democrats. What was that about?
Okay, so there has been some rumors going around for a while that the White House was going to try a new strategy. They were going to start reaching out for centrist Democrats, rank-and-file members, bring them to the White House, wine and dine them, and try to basically get them to break away from Pelosi and support efforts to fund the wall and reopen the government.
Right. These are all the Democrats who are calling him all the time.
According to him, yes. And they've, hinted that they've already spoken to a lot of members who have been open to this and are ready to do just that. So it looks like today there was going to be an effort to try to start carrying out that strategy. And the White House ended up saying that they had a constructive meeting where they figured out what everybody wants. What didn't really get reported or noted as much or as broadly was that these rank-and-file members who are from the Problem Solvers Caucus, sort of an offshoot of No Labels, ones that aren't necessarily known for great moments in political courage, basically came to the White House and gave the president the same answer that the Democratic leadership has been giving him for a while now, which is open up the government and then we'll talk. They said that that was actually why they accepted the meeting. They wanted to sit down with him and tell him that they are open for negotiations, but not until the government is reopened. And that is effectively the last thing that the White House wanted to hear, since they were very gung-ho on pursuing this until they get the votes to pretty much open things up unilaterally and fund the wall. So this was a defeat for one of the more esoteric and ham-fisted strategies that they've had out there on the table.
Yeah, I was surprised I didn't see temper tantrum Twitter, much along the lines of crying Chuck and Nancy and all of that. I was surprised I didn't see any whining Twitters. And by wine and dine, did you mean hamburgers?
From what I understand, it was yesterday they served lunch-sized steak to the members, a steak and potatoes dinner or lunch for the Republican members who came. Not sure what they had today, but I imagine no hamburgers, which was a weird. God, it already feels like a lifetime ago. I was actually the pooler that day, and that was one of the more surreal events.
Look, I try not to beat people up for, you know, having big fingers and you know, having weird words pop up because for like me, I got big thumbs. So, you know, I come up with some weird words. I do try and proofread occasionally, but I'm not going to beat him up too much for that. Beat him up for, you know, serving, you know, hamburgers and French fries and, you know, cold hamburgers and soggy French fries to athletes who, you know, probably don't touch any of that stuff. But, yeah, you know, good on him, right?
No, I got to say, so I was there that day, if you just let me go on that little tangent here.
Hit me.
I was on the South Lawn. Marine One came down, blew the snow in everybody's faces. I was absolutely, you know, covered in snow, couldn't quite see anything. My glasses are all fogged up. You know, he goes into the White House. Suddenly, I'm grabbed by the wranglers there, the White House staffers who generally guide us from place to place, and told that we all have to run into the White House right away. The small, you know, group of reporters who follow him every day, they run me through the White House. I'm still covered in snow. I can't see anything. And then suddenly I'm led into a room with a table that's piled high with Big Macs and, you know, cheeseburgers and chicken McNuggets and just all this random food with the President of the United States standing over it while I'm covered in snow and still not really able to see. And he starts talking about, you know, cheeseburgers and the shutdown and making some kind of political connection over that. And I just have to say that was probably one of the strangest experiences I've had in D.C.
That's got to be the strangest thing that I've ever seen. I mean, the image of him standing over this, you know, this giant mound of what had to be lukewarm, because there's nothing worse than cold fast food. I mean, I can't imagine that you would serve that to people. But, you know, hey, I guess he broke out his gift cards or what, you know, got, they increased his tab. I don't know, but just very, very bizarre.
No, I mean, some things you wake up expecting, and when I woke up that day, I did not imagine that I was going to be addressed by the leader of the free world with a smorgasbord of fast food options.
Yeah, a heart attack waiting to happen. I do find it interesting that Burger King took a shot at him. I just kind of throwing it out there, considering all the free PR they got. You know, I guess the Canadian company, it is what it is, you know?
Well, I mean, interestingly enough, there was a there wasn't really that much Burger King on the table, and I think that's largely due to the fact that McDonald's has a better 2-for-5 deal than Burger King has right now. So I think this may have been a cost-cutting maneuver. So maybe they were a little bit irked by that.
There you go. One of the funniest comments I saw were, you know, you didn't see any salad around, especially the salad with the Russian dressing.
Well, to be fair, there was salad on the table, but that's still a good gag. I like that.
I had to laugh over the Russian dressing part. And finally, today someone was handing out fake Washington Post newspapers that the president had resigned.
Yeah, so this was all over D.C., around the White House's metro station.
Did you get me one?
I didn't get one, but I've you know, seen a lot of the issues of it, and they also have it online. So it turns out that this was a fake newspaper, basically saying that Trump had resigned and painting this counterfactual scenario where Mike Pence was coming in as a clip duck president, now under investigation as well. And it turns out that this was from the Yes Men, who are a group of culture jammers that have been operating for a while now. People who have carried out some pretty elaborate pranks previously. Back in 2008, when I first moved to D.C., they were giving out free fake issues of the New York Times that were basically calling out the Iraq War and taking, you know, some of the columnists like Tom Friedman to task. They've previously booked television appearances pretending to, you know, be lobbyists from coal companies and whatnot and saying, you know, these just outrageous things on television. So it was a stunt that they pulled off, a pretty bold one, one that you know, I guess irked a lot of people, but certainly added another element of weirdness and humor in what was already a pretty strange day.
Yeah, if you're going to hell, you might as well laugh on the way, right?
There you go. Exactly.
I can't imagine the amount of money that went into putting that out and all of the stuff, because the website looks exactly like the Washington Post website. I mean, it looked real. I saw images. I would love to get my hands on a copy of it, though, but I'll probably all sucked up by now.
I'll keep an eye out. If I get one, I'll pass it your way.
My hero. Appreciate it, man. Good stuff. Justin, as always, appreciate the time.
Thank you so much, Rick. Have a good one.
Justin Duckham, Talk Media News. I can't imagine. I can't imagine walking in and seeing this just giant buffet table on silver trays of of cooling fast food. Because look, there's nothing worse than cold French fries or freedom fries. Can't call them French fries anymore. They're freedom fries. I guess you can do nothing but laugh at this point. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Are we making too much of nothing? I just think we're in big trouble. Quick break. Right back.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1946. That was the day the United Packing House Workers of America went on strike. Their initial demand was for a 25-cent-an-hour raise.